Okay, this is September 28, 2008, and we're beginning our 19th hour with Gerd Stern, poet of communications. And in the last few weeks, I received in the mail from Gerd a booklet assembled 20 years ago of articles and reviews extending the whole history of USCO and into intermedia. So since we've done the nomenclature of Gerd's past, the names and people and interesting patterns, I want to talk to Gerd now as an artist, as a thinker, and what he is today in relation to what he and Michael did 40 years ago, and get into more intellectual talk, maybe, or whatever it leads to. What's interesting, Gerd, we have at the beginning of the booklet the dates for Who Are You? And this is the pamphlet. This is the actual pamphlet handed out, right? That I'm looking at. It says, two performances by tape-telephone-television, and then the next line, projected images, starring live public figures out of the verbal American landscape. I mean, that sounds like Crossfire. Live public figures out of the verbal American landscape. Then it says, conceived and produced by poet Gerd Stern in association with painter Ivan Mazdrikov. Sociologist Howard Becker? Is it Howard Becker? Yeah.
Yeah, Howie Becker.
Yeah, and the San
Francisco... He's quite a well-known sociologist, and for the last few years now, he's been working on the sociology of photography.
Okay, and where is he teaching, in San Francisco?
No, he's retired from both California and the University of Chicago, or rather, Northwestern.
Right.
He lives in San Francisco, but they spend a few months a year in Paris also, he and his second wife.
Is that Alison Becker?
No, Alison was his daughter, and she's now grown, but she was the one who was, if you see the picture of the little girl, that was Alison.
Okay, I'm going to go into that a bit in a minute. So, and that's the sociologist Howard Becker in the San Francisco Tape Music Center, and that's Michael. Michael Callahan. So starting at 8 p.m. sharp, the word sharp, you don't see that anymore, really, do you? S-H-A-R-P?
No.
Tuesday, November 12th to Thursday, November 14th. So it's a week before the Kennedy assassination. Not after, it's before.
Okay.
In the auditorium of the San Francisco Museum of Art.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Museum of Art at McAllister Street at Van Ness Avenue. The tickets are $2 for the general public and $1.50 for museum members. Available at the museum bookshop. Send your check to the San Francisco Museum Education Department. Student tickets, $1 with student cards. Get your tickets now. Oh, yeah, so it says, who are you at the top, and at the bottom it says, what's happening?
Yeah, it was called Who Are You and What's Happening.
Right. Now, in the program it says... these performances are studies toward a larger multimedia presentation, the verbal American landscape. In my, and this is Gerd Stern, this is a quote from you, in my Guggenheim Foundation proposal for this work, I wrote, quote, the audience may be regarded and valued from a viewpoint of effect as still another recording apparatus capable of multi-level operations. Read that again. The audience may be regarded and valued from a viewpoint of effect as still another recording apparatus capable of multi-level operations. Then,
right.
Any comment on that? Is that before
well, I mean,
the?
It's what in Germany, German would be called Selbstverständlich, which means self assured. It's probably not an exact translation. But, that's what it says is what it means.
Right, so that is what's on the program, but the feedback distorts all that, right? The unforeseen feedback.
Yeah, well, you read the...
Yeah, we're going to get to that, yeah. So just continuing the program, it says, sociologists on the control panel are Howard Becker, Sheldon Messinger, if you want to say anything about these people as I read them, David Sudnow, and Paul Verdon. Intermission inquiries by Paul Verdon. I've never heard of those people.
Yeah, well, there were four booths on stage, plastic gazebos, and in each of them were sitting four quasi-public figures, including the mayor and Ginsburg and various others, Herb Cain, and the phones connected the sociologist panel with the gazebos so that they could prompt the speakers in those four gazebos on a subject or kind of provoke them. And of course, it was all being recorded, which, since it was a very complex feat of recording that many separate channels, and it also involved the phone lines between the sociologists who each had a phone connected into all four of the gazebos. It was fairly high-tech stuff, especially for the time, which was a time of a very different state-of-the-art technology. And I had been looking for technical help, and Michael McClure sent me to the Tape Music Center, where Ramon Sender and Morton Subotnick and Paulino Oliveros were, and Morton and Ramon, who I didn't know at the time, said to me, I explained to them what I wanted to do. They said, Michael, who's does all of our hardware stuff, he can help you. So I was introduced to Michael, and I explained to him what I was doing. He got a lot of the ideas very quickly, and Judith McBean, who was helping me produce it, was able to borrow a lot of the technology. Her family was fairly socially prominent around there, and we borrowed the television equipment and the telephone equipment, and et cetera, et cetera. And,
but is it Michael? Is it Michael who does the wiring? Do you help
him?
Yes,
it's Michael does the wiring with me helping, and probably some other people too, friends of ours.
And he's only about 19 years old at the time.
That's right. And it was way above his
position at the center?
Not his position at the center, but there were more complexities than we had foreseen, we didn't have the appropriate switchboards or things of that sort. It all had to be kludged together, and so what resulted was a very different experience than one had anticipated, but it was a very dynamic and rather impressive mix in any case.
Let me interject here. When you have your retrospectives over the last few years, do people talk about this piece? Is this noticed, or they look more at what you presented at Riverside?
Yeah, I mean, the more attention is paid to that Riverside period, the USCO period, than to that early period. I think less people know about Who Are You and what's happening. It was, at the time, well, you saw the review, right? Landmark of a flop.
Yeah, I'm going to read it.
Well, did I tell you the story about it?
Yes, the guy who wrote this is a key...
Alfred Frankenstein, yes.
Yeah, but in light of the importance of this show, in retrospect, I'm looking up what I sent you. Remember my email? Did you see it? Found it. James Joyce and Radio. Did you?
Yes. Thank you. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, fantastic quote. And I'm going to... I'm going to read this for the record, because this is what Michael, you're saying, would be really interested in. this scholarly supplement on the Finnegan's Wake action by James Joyce. It says, now the guy who did this was a Jesuit priest, and this was published in the James Joyce Quarterly in July 1993. And it says, a summary on the web of what the paper essay was about. It says, James Connor appears to be making three main statements. One, that James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake is an information-rich, high-entropy poetic work straddling order and chaos. That radio fundamentally changed, I guess this would be the second point, that radio fundamentally changed the way people interface with the world and each other. And third, a consciousness of the noise and communicative potential of early radio informed Joyce's approach to writing this text. Then it says, Connor first argues that Finnegan's Wake is a text which, quote, at first glance appears to be nearly pure chaos, but is slyly not so. Connor compares this to the idea of entropy in information theory, in brackets where he interprets entropy as a peak in information between pure order and pure chaos, and suggests that the Wake was constructed in such a way that it packs a measure of improbability into every line. After this, Connor gives a brief history of early radio, touching on its instability, noise, and social significance. Then he builds his case for radio's influence on Joyce, drawing passages from the Wake to support this. Now, I think that's interesting about, you know, what happens in the 70s and the rise of information theory or the MIT world that you enter, that kind of thinking is prominent, right? Information theory and cybernetics.
Absolutely.
Right. And then the next comment is by, I don't know who this is by, but it's another commentary on what Connor writes. It says, Connor's thesis, James Joyce's writings, in particular Finnegan's Wake, published in 1939, were highly influenced by the radio signal-to-noise ratio of the era. In Radio Free Joyce, that's the name of the essay, Connor suggests that radio static, drift, multi-station noise, recording, and playback technologies influenced Joyce's authorship style in Finnegan's Wake. Joyce was heavily influenced by distant radio signals from his homeland of Ireland. The ways in which...
Radio Free what?
The essay is called Radio Free Joyce.
Wow.
And the
is that what you sent me?
Yes. The subtitle is Finnegan's Wake Language and the Experience of Radio,
right,
by James Connor, but the title is Radio Free Joyce.
Yeah.
And the ways in which Joyce wrote parallel the expressions that radio noise over distance creates, similar to dream, entropy, or stream of consciousness. You know, the idea of Finnegan's Wake's a dream.
Yeah.
And the stream of consciousness of Ulysses, and then the entropy. All those three are brought together in Finnegan's Wake. And it's not any of them in particular if you miss the radio aspect. And in his writing, Joyce reformulated the language, this is a quote, Joyce reformulated the language of advertising and the structure of technology and reset them in an older form, the novel. In so doing, he increased the amount of information that could be passed from one place to another with language. He reset the linguistic level of entropy. Then it says, Connor's analysis of Joyce's linguistic experiments is interesting. Joyce's writing does seem to inhabit and draw from a world of noise, one which, like the world of radio noise in the early realm of signal broadcasting, exists, quote, in the boundary between pure order and pure chaos. I mean, that is what you guys were and confronting once the feedback thing happened, you know, in your
presentation. Yeah, well, the feedback happened, and later on the overload that we produced in the multi-channel environments, which was not our intention, but, you know, it was so entrancing to keep expanding the number of channels.
Right.
And not programming anything, but in a sense, a lot of our early programming was, once we were doing, you know, multimedia shows, was for the aha syndrome idea, which, you know, I kind of grabbed from psychology, but what it meant in multimedia is that the more channels you had going with all kinds of images and information, then every member of the audience would pick up something which was familiar to them and which wasn't necessarily familiar to the people. people on either side or the other parts of the audience, but that was enough. Once something familiar grabs you, then the rest of everything seems to rotate around it, you know?
Exactly.
And signal-to-noise ratio is the way that they use. He used it in this essay is a little non-technical, right? Because it's a threshold there that you have to worry about when the noise grows. To be the majority rather than the signal, and of course, he says it very clearly. When the radio signal is far away, I mean, it used to be in the United States when you would cross the country, right? You would hear these bizarre noises, which were far away radio stations, where it was simply sound of very large frequency spectrum coming at you, rather than signal. Of course, for some people that is signal. Noise and signal are just arbitrary terms to identify kind of a polarized ambiguity between what you can recognize and what you can't.
Yeah.
Numerically, there's not that much difference, right, if you want to quantify it.
Yes.
All right, I've said enough.
Yeah, what you sparked my mind is, in that poetry review I sent you, I talk about one of the discoveries of the 20th century was the idea that the user is the content, and this was really expressed in Finnegan's Wake. And that's what you're saying. The user finds something in an information overload environment that they recognize, and then that becomes the fulcrum of the vortex of meaning from the rest of the stuff.
Yeah, and it's that, the instance between the blur and the focus.
Yeah.
It's like when you have one of those lenses that you can focus and all of a sudden, there's a point of sharpness there, which allows you to absorb the blur and its significance. You know, because in the blur you have all the interference patterns and the kind of the harmonics, and those are really what the emotional effect. It's those waveforms rather than what we tend to refer to as information.
Right. The blurring is the emotion. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Emotion guided.
Yeah, it's a harmonic blurring.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's frequency modulation is one way of looking at it. And, it's a lot different than amplitude.
Right.
Modulation.
It's in McLuhan's letter to Innes, one of the few letters he wrote to him, 1951. He ends it by saying, the real thing to focus on is frequency modulation, not amplitude modulation.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Wow.
Yes, I don't have the letters here with me, but we'll get that quote to you. It's amazing.
Well, when I entered the radio world at
KPFA,
it was at the very start of FM.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of FM around yet, and it was a big problem that we had because we had to get subscribers for the first listener-sponsored station in the world.
Yeah.
And my solution to it was I made a deal with this company. Did I tell you this already?
I don't think so.
A company named Granco. It was a Japanese company that made little, very, at the time, very small FM radios and FM tuners, and we put together a deal with them to buy 100 at a time, and we then packaged that with subscription. And then I had antenna volunteers who would put up your antenna for you, so this went all the way down from the San Francisco area through to the valley to get reception. And I didn't have a ghost about what frequency modulation meant, you know, but I had to learn it because, you know, I mean, people wanted to know what the difference was between AM and FM, and I, you know, so it was a kind of a technical education on that level, which later on I depended on Michael, and I've kind of ever since, as well as my son Zalman.
Right, and you realize it was probably about March 51 when McClellan was writing that letter to Innes that you were trying to market these things in San Francisco.
Hey.
It was around 51 you were out there doing that, wasn't it?
Oh, you mean the
setting up the
KPFA?
Yeah.
No, KPFA was for me was later than 51, but
very close, 52, 53.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And I wanted to bring up McClellan because, you know, you this thing about Joyce, you know, using radio. No one perceived that in the wake in the 50s and 60s except for McClellan. He was the only one who understood that's what was going on in the wake and wrote about it in 52, 53. And what's interesting is that you're doing this performance and, you know, 40 years later, this Finnegan's Wake idea is really significant to you. But you were influenced by McClellan, but you didn't know that about Finnegan's Wake. You didn't know that about Joyce and Finnegan's Wake and shortwave radio. But you were...
I didn't know that at all, but I had read...
McClellan's report.
No, yes, I had read McClellan's report, but I had already read Ulysses, and I had tried to read Finnegan's Wake.
Right, right, like everybody did.
And you know, there was a consciousness of the, of how the assemblage of fragmentary material could become some kind of a work of art.
And that was definitely influenced by looking at Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, and understanding that poetry would never be the same.
Yes, yeah.
And it still isn't. And, you
no.
know, I just, as I told you, I spent this weekend, and I wrote a poem out of it, which I haven't put on the computer yet, but I'll send it to you. And it's composed of, you know, stuff that was in the air.
Right.
You know, and radio is simply an extension of conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's a realization which is most people don't make the connection.
No.
But if you think of what happens when you're on the electric radio, you're conversing. You're conversing with anybody who's in the studio with you, but you're really conversing with the people out there, even though they can't respond, except nowadays, of course,
yep.
There are so many interactive telephone programs on the radio that it's a total kind of interchange medium, which it didn't used to be. I mean, when I was at KPFA, we didn't have callers in.
No.
I mean, none of the shows, and now on WBAI, I think half the shows take calls, you know.
That's right.
And in commercial radio, it's probably even more than that.
Right. Now, we did an interview with Paris Flamand, the writer in the 1560s, and he was on Long John Nebel's show. He produced that. You remember that show?
Sure.
Yeah, and well, he was from Paris, was the producer for many years, late 50s,
wow.
early 60s. And I think he talked about, am I right, Scott? He talked about taking calls. Remember that? And they had to devise a technical gadget, but because they had to put a delay in, but they didn't have electronic digital delays.
That's right. There were all those delay things to keep people from...
Yeah, swearing on the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But to me, that was a pretty breakthrough show, Long John Nebel's. That might have been the first phone-in show. I'm not sure. But
I'm not sure either, but, you know, I mean...
That's years after you doing KPFA.
And it's an antecedent to what Harold Channer does, right?
Yes, yeah. And the other thing was, wasn't Joe Pyne the Mort Downey, Jerry Springer of phone-in radio back in the 60s?
I don't know. I don't know that name.
Oh, okay.
You know.
But definitely.
But a lot of the DJs, you know, in the 50s and 60s, of course, they wanted people to call and tell them what they should play.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of it also.
That's right.
Not that people had conversations, but that they called and said, I want to hear this.
Yeah. Yeah, and that probably was going on in the 50s, though I'm not sure.
Yes, I think so. It certainly was going on, along with Murray the K.
Yeah, yeah.
In New York, and even in jazz, Pat's name? And we used to hang out with him in Oakland. Jazz DJ. Huh.
And he would take calls.
Yes.
Okay, the other thing, you talk about this blur, that's the pun. The pun is the linguistic way of expressing the oscillation between blur and precision, or blur and information,
blur,
right?
And focus.
Blur and focus.
And Harry Parch, and I don't know if this is true, but Harry Parch told me that focus, spelled slightly differently, was the name of the narrow pass where Oedipus met and slew his father. It's where three roads met.
Ah, yeah.
Focus.
Yeah, I think you already told us that, and also I think with the Japanese company, I don't know if you named it, but you did talk about getting these little receivers, marketing them on the when you started the KPFA. But so you came up with the solution for Lou Hill with this FM idea.
It was only a partial solution, but it was, you know, at a time when FM was not that many people had the equipment. It was a way of adding to our small, tiny at that time subscriber list, and we did manage to distribute some hundreds of them around, and because it was cheap, because as I remember, they were $49.95 for, you know, you got one, and plus you had the subscription, which I can't remember what it cost at the time. It probably only cost $15 or $20, it really worked. And of course the networking of having these antenna volunteer groups in all of the towns in the area meant that I had these kind of loyal subscribers who, when they went and installed the antennas, they made friends. The people had to buy the antennas, but we installed them for them, because you know, outside of the Bay Area, and we were able to broadcast because we were at the top. The transmitter was on top of the mountain above Berkeley and Oakland.
What was the name of that mountain?
Oh, God.
Okay, you can't remember. It's all right.
I don't think it was Diablo, but it could have been Diablo.
Right.
I don't think so. But anyway, it was a torturous path. When it got muddy, and we had to keep working on that, and somebody had to be up there all the time. I can't remember the numbers of the license. You had to have a license to be able to sit in the transmitter, and check all of the frequency things. I mean, it was like an elaborate little ritual of things that you had to do and write it down on a log and call into the station to tell them that you had done it on the hour. You know.
Yeah. The when you think of the bulkiness or something of that public discussion, and then today where anybody can broadcast to each other and instant message, I guess the telephone was equal to that back then, but now it's visual telephone. What you were doing is like caveman stuff, just setting up.
I have the sentimental scene going in my head every time I see something or perceive something, some new modus of technology. I think, oh shit, man, if Marshall could only see this happen, you know?
Yeah. Well, he said it was all in Finnegan's Wake, so we want to know what he thought. We look in Finnegan's Wake to see if it is in there, the pattern, and it is. And that's what Don Thiel developed, the digital...
Yeah, the pattern's in there, but, you know, the details are so entrancing that I know how he felt when he saw something or heard something, and it really, you could see how it turned him on.
That's right. Well, you know that I've spoken to him supposedly through a medium, right? You've heard me talk about that. Well,
yes, I heard you.
Yeah, he would go, Bob, oh boy! He would see the future, and he'd go, oh Bob, oh boy! Like a little kid in a toy shop. He says, you won't believe about what's coming. And the medium, Michael Blake Reed, he'd be dreaming. And then he would come out of deep trance after being in the trance for an hour, and then we'd tape his dreams, like his brain was recording, getting impressions. And he said he loved talking to Marshall because Marshall would keep showing him new gadgets. And I remember about 10 years ago, it was in 1998, 1999, Michael came out of a session, he says, it was unbelievable. Everybody was on the air. Everybody was broadcasting. Millions of people. And he said, McCool was saying, look at this. It's Finnegan's Wake. Here comes everybody. That, and Michael didn't know anything about Finnegan's Wake, but that's what McCool was saying to him. You know, in the dream images of his brain interpreting what me and the spirit of McCool, whatever that spirit was, I don't claim it to be McCool, but it was something new McCool, you know, knew how to talk like McCool. And he was just blown away by it all. McCool was, you know, what was coming, and he predicted you.
I felt that every time something, you know, really spectacular hits me. That
you go, wish Mars was here. There was another idea. Oh yeah, so. Who had the idea? Is it particular to Lou Hill to have the first subscriber or audience paying thing?
Well, it was Lou's idea was that the United States America needed a tradition of communication, you know, and he was a conscientious objector, and he wanted people to be totally involved in promoting this kind of thing, and that and you know, what's his name at the Ford Foundation?
Robert Hutchins?
Yeah, Robert Hutchins, you know, who provided most of the initial funding. I think together Lou and Hutchins evolved the idea of a listener-sponsored radio station. Yeah, and Hutchins was fairly brilliant.
Right, now that's, on the side, when we talk about Mark Stallman having a problem, you know, he thinks Robert Hutchins was an enemy of McLuhan, and he'll go on about Robert Hutchins, and the LaRouche people talk about how evil Hutchins was. And that's an example of Mark's having a totally different experience about Hutchins than you do. I mean, you have an experience of Hutchins helping you do something you believed in.
Well, I mean, I was Johnny Come Lately on that level, but, you know, and then he moved from the Ford Foundation to that place in
Aspen,
California.
Oh, no, the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, which McLuhan spoke at in the early 60s.
Right. Yeah, right.
Okay, so we were, but the, so as Lou and Hutchins, or Lou came up with the idea that the listener sponsored that, the idea that people would listen and pay for it and keep it going. That was the idea?
That was the idea, yes, that it would be self-funding instead of commercially funding.
And no one had ever thought of that or done it before.
No, no, it hadn't been done. And, but I think, like I said, that Hutchins was also involved, and because it was with that idea in mind that Ford Foundation gave, you know, what could be conceived as a startup grant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know how foundations are. They don't want to feel that they've got to keep something going for the rest of its life. They're willing to give a grassroots startup, and then you're supposed to be self-supporting after a while. And so this idea of the listener sponsorship, then the Ford Foundation bought the transmitter and funded the first, I think at least a year, if not longer, of the station operation until, you know, the revenues started really becoming considerable from listener sponsorship.
Yeah, now the intertwining of people's lives, Hutchins in the 40s was approached by McLuhan when he was the head at the University of Chicago and was running
was not only that, but was kind of very tightly intertwined with Mortimer Adler.
Yes, and so McLuhan criticized in an essay in 46 or so, he criticized Adler and Hutchins as on being on one side of the ancient quarrel, he called it, in modern America, between the sophists and the dialecticians. And McLuhan was more, at least publicly, on the sophist side. So he goes to Adler and Hutchins and presents a curriculum. They were working out a university curriculum, post-World War II stuff, maybe GI Bill curriculum and things like that, and they had a big falling out, and what McLuhan presented was too complex. Something like that.
Adler wanted to simplify everything, right?
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that, well, first I'll just say, and Mark takes McLuhan's side in the argument, apparent argument with Hutchins, or Mark's version of McLuhan is what Mark thinks he's supporting. So, but what's interesting is that McLuhan ends up working with you, but you were made possible in one part of your life by Hutchins. See the cross thing here? This McLuhan-Hutchins dialogue, debate, you're caught in between going from one benefiting from both sides.
That's right.
Yeah, which is pretty interesting. Okay, so when Bob Fast talks to you occasionally on the show, does he know you did this at KPFA?
Yes. In fact, I just got from somebody else a letter which was sent to Lou Hill as if he were alive by the former manager of Pacific Foundation. I just sent her an email the day before yesterday telling her, she said she had found in the store room in a corner, a dusty old little FM radio that we had used the Granco. She didn't mention it, and so I wrote her an email and I said, "Hey, you wrote that wonderful letter to Lou Hill, kind of saying what's happening now and how that relates to what you started, and you mentioned the radio. It was me who got those radios together." Yeah.
And has she responded?
No, not yet.
And what is she? The manager of what?
She was. I think she resigned. She was the director of Pacifica Foundation.
Yeah, which is always in turmoil. Been in turmoil for years now, right? So people are coming and going.
Yeah.
So is she? She was writing it's like writing to Ben Franklin. Look what happened to America. Is this is what you mean? It's writing to Lou,
exactly,
to lay out her grievances of what's happening.
partially that, yes, and to compliment him on what he had done.
Right.
And her name is Nicole. It's Nicole at Pacifica.org.
Just Nicole, okay.
It starts with an S, but I can't quite remember what.
Okay, we went back to the 50s, and we're going back forward to the 60s. And I want to continue the program here for Who Are You? What's Happening? It says, word images for the slide poem were chosen by Ivan Mazurkov. Now, we haven't talked a lot about Ivan, but there's a lot about him in the Bancroft. What is it? Bancroft? I forget the name of school.
Yeah, well, he wrote the
preface.
Also.
Yeah, what's the name of the school or the library? Bancroft?
Bancroft.
Yeah.
Library, yeah.
Yeah. But he is a guy who goes way back to your teens. He's a long-time partner of yours through the years.
Before the teens, we were in public school
okay, that means with Henry Kissinger? Well, that's a school?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, word images for the slide poem were chosen by Ivan Mazurkov and Gerd Stern and photographed by Ivan Mazurkov, who was also in charge of projection. Projection is for Tuesday, our Max, I'm just saying these names, see if they bring back memories, our Max Finstein,
wow,
Jack Overhoff,
yep,
and Simon Perkoff.
Wow.
They're probably all dead, right?
Most of them, yes.
Yeah. Projectionist for Thursday are Ron W. Davis, Carl Glicko, and Joe White.
I don't even remember who they are.
The performance photographer is Fred Lyon.
Oh, yeah. Fred's still around.
Right. Now, Morton Zapotnik, was he famous back then? He becomes famous later.
I don't know that he's ever been really famous, but he's a well-known modern contemporary composer.
Was he then, 40 years ago? Was he older?
No, the three of them were running the...
the Tate Music Center.
Yeah.
And were they older than you?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, it says audio engineering is by Michael Callahan and audio mix by Michael Callahan, Raymond Sender, Morton Zapotnik, all of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. All of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. Most of the audio equipment is by courtesy of the San Francisco Tape Music Center. Telephones, courtesy Pacific Telephone. Closed circuit television cameras spelled wrong, and monitors courtesy of Sylvania Electric Products, and monitors courtesy of Airtronics San Francisco, specialists in closed circuit television.
Okay, the woman's name is Nicole Sawaya, S-A-W-A-Y-A.
S-A-W-A-Y-A. It's like Hawaii, Sawaya. Okay.
And
I don't know her.
No, but it's a very interesting letter. It's, dear Lou Hill, greetings. My name is Nicole Sawaya, and currently I'm the executive director and chief executive of the radio endeavor you started called Pacifica. It's changed a lot.
Oh, read some more.
You wouldn't believe what your, in quotes, killer app, some might portray it, in 21st century lexicon has spawned. And it goes on from there.
No, keep going. Let's get this on the record. This is good. Your killer app. Pacifica,
yeah, now
there
are five stations licensed to Pacifica in densely populated and rolling urban areas, millions of human beings within earshot, all with easy access to the cheapest and most accessible broadcast mediums on the planet, radio. Yes, the planet. There is an archive of programming and folios spanning decades, a repository and collection of voices that truly belongs to the people as part of the history of our country and the world. And there are over 100 smaller stations scattered through rural and urban settings, cities and towns and ridgetops affiliated with Pacifica and broadcasting our program, a network that has been in place for quite a while. Beyond that, your notion that the listeners would voluntarily financially support radio journalism and cultural exchange created a model for many, many non-commercial educational radio stations to apply your vision of public ownership of the airwaves put into practice with the radio license you applied for and grew as the first nonprofit community licensee station, gained great traction and has been replicated exponentially.
Carry on. It's interesting.
We don't exchange the subscriber radios anymore for pledges, and you wouldn't recognize how the fundraising marathons have changed. It's a bit like an on-air shopping experience, but listeners continue to support us voluntarily with their hard-earned money, and they're not necessarily just bound to radios to listen to us. An aside, when I was briefly general manager of your first station, KPFA, there was a subscriber radio in the office, but it was tucked away and dusty. When I discovered it soon after taking the job, I was so excited to learn of its history. It completely inspired me as Pacific was heading to its 50th anniversary. So elegant, so innovative for its time, so smart. Mr. Hill, what you conceived has had one of the highest impacts in media history. Not just the staunch belief in listener support, but your notions that journalistic enterprises should remain unfettered from any sort of business support in order to maintain credibility, that to help in striving for a more peaceful and just world radio, or what we now refer to as media programming, should give access to myriad viewpoints and in-depth news, coupled with an exposure to the arts, and to cultures and happenings from all over the world. That innovation is vital. Have all lived on. You were a pioneer. Fast forward to today. Our country is at war. Our government is a death machine abroad and a fear machine at home. Our broadcast media is in general mind-numbingly useless, filled with shameless propagandists and completely profit-driven. The Earth climate is changing radically, and the gap between rich and poor is larger than the Grand Canyon, with by far the larger group on the poor end. I could go on, but it would take a while. Your Pacific is showing signs of stress as well. Sadly, it is no longer focused on service to the listeners, but absorbed with itself and the inhabitants therein. I call it Planet Pacifica, a term I can coined during my hiring process. There is an underlying culture of grievance coupled with entitlement, and its governance structure is dysfunctional. The bylaws of the organization have opened it up to tremendous abuse, creating the opportunity for cronyism, factionalism, and faux democracy, with the result of challenging all yet helping nothing. Pacifica has been made so flat that it is concave. No leadership is possible without an enormous struggle through the inertia that committees and collectives and STVs know, not sexually transmitted viruses, but single transferable votes can engender. You want me to go?
Yeah.
Pacifica calls itself a movement, yet currently it behaves like a jobs program, a cult, or a social service agency. And oftentimes the loudest and most obstreperous have the privilege of the microphone. There are endless meetings of committees and task forces, mostly on the phone, where people just like to hear themselves talk. Sometimes they get lucrative contracts from their grandstanding. It's been grueling for someone in my position, someone like me, who is not a process person, much less a political gamer. I keep asking, what's the end game? Paralysis has set in, coupled with organizational drift. The programming isn't attracting many listeners anymore either. It skews toward the narrow in its editorial stance, leans toward the niche, and change to the programming can't occur without a fight. The listening audience is small. In other words, the stations have yet to grow into their large signals. Business practices are oftentimes shoddy and opaque and mirror the culture of our times. Lots of self-interest with a focus on individual needs as opposed to performance, affordability, or the common good. And we've hit some tough economic times without having the general will to do the hard work necessary in order to ensure sustainability contracting rather than continually expanding the size of our financial obligations. Basically, resources and airtime have been allocated for internal political purposes at the expense of service to audience, innovation, or the care and feeding of our broadcast physical infrastructure. Some of this has to do with the fact that very few people, either on air or off air, actually have radio experience other than being part of Pacifica. That was not the case with you, nor is it with me. Conversely, there are many dedicated... That isn't true, though. I mean, Lou had no radio experience before.
Right.
Conversely, there are many dedicated and smart people working within Pacifica. They may not work at full speed. It is rather comfortable, especially for those who work unsupervised, but they make a consistent effort to give voice to the voiceless and hold government and power accountable. And those who work without self-interest are giving constant grief to management. A four-letter word in Pacifica are to be applauded. It keeps on going.
Okay, let's just hold there. I don't know. Yeah. Is there a lot more?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's excellent. I mean, because
the last part says, I hope that all stakeholders remember that Pacifica is a public trust, a veritable weapon of mass information, and keep a big vision in play rather than petty politics.
Right, but what's really appropriate for this is that Joyce, this line between chaos and order, Lou Hill in a smaller, tiny media world offered an orderly way to present audience participation and the voiceless get a chance to talk. And then you push that experience, plus new media comes in, it flips into chaos. And it's so chaotic in the information world now that you can't even hear Pacifica unless you somehow find a needle in the haystack. And so the very problem that Lou Hill, if he was alive today, looking back at what happened to WBAI and Pacifica, is the same thing that you and Michael have looking back. You know what I mean? Now, this is what's interesting.
A certain sense of sadness and practically guilt.
Yeah. And that's in Bob Fass's voice every week. Sadness, guilt, but still plugging on, trying to do something, right? Hope that there's some reason for WBA.
I fixed it up for Neil to have this last Thursday a program with Bob.
Oh, he was on?
Yeah, I'll send you the URL.
Oh, no, I just go into the archives.
Yeah.
It'll be up for a week. But Bob had a fantastic show on the week before with Robert Downey Sr.
Oh, yeah, that was when Neil was supposed to be on, and Bob asked him to
hold off,
postpone it another week, yeah.
Had Bob met Neil before?
Yeah, once many years ago, but he had kind of forgotten it, so I kind of read.
Bob had forgotten it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's Neil Goldsmith we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the archives only last about a week, but I'll listen to it because I'm glad I tuned in last week. I checked Bob Fass's show occasionally and heard I listened to the whole 3.5 hours because Downey was you know him? He's a great guy who did Putney Swope and Greaser's Palace, the great filmmaker.
Yeah, I know who it is.
Yeah.
But I've never known him. Yeah,
and his son is Robert Downey Jr., you know, the famous Hollywood actor. But... you know, Bob's show evokes stuff from the street and all kinds of interesting things. You'll hear things.
Well, when I replied to Nicole, I said that I was a pal of Bob's because he's the one person who really reminds me of what Lou had in mind.
Right, and it.
But also Amy Goodman, by the way. But that's a very different subject.
Yeah. So the very problems that at Pacifica are happening to any part of the counterculture that we have gone through with you, all of it got blasted, and in looking back, you don't know if one was aware enough. But that's where I think...
Well, organizational institutions like Pacifica have had the worst kind of conflicts politically and economically...
individuals have done well, we could say, right? Individuals have adapted?
Not within those structures.
I don't mean that within those. I mean just individuals themselves, like yourself.
Yes.
Like yourself. You adapted and changed through the decades.
Yeah, but it's been very damaging, for instance, to people like Bob Fass, what's happened at Pacifica.
Yeah.
And to a lot of other people, too. But
she's right to point out...
But those kind of dynamics are endemic, you know. It's not the fault of what happened to Pacifica. It's a societal wave of conduct that just kind of invades every kind of organization.
Well, that's where McLuhan was the most aware of what was coming if we didn't know what we were doing with this new media. That's where he was the closest, and he got those clues from Finnegan's Wake and Wyndham Lewis. You know, that's the wisdom that he had, and that 40 years later, Michael, in his interview in Art Forum, is meditating on what McLuhan meant, you know, and the richer dynamics of it. And okay, what was I going to say? There was something. Oh, yeah, but she's right about the incredible archive. When people had ears to listen. I don't know if they do anymore, the younger generations. I don't know if they care. They listen to what they want to listen to, but it's transitory. But the history of the 20th century is the most people's century ever, probably, right? The most working man's century in terms of the wealth, the abundance, the communication, the interaction for the working man, the 20th century. The record of that, a lot of it, is in the Pacific Archives.
Yes, among others, yes.
Yeah. But Finnegan's Wake was meant to be an archive of everything, because Joyce saw that it would be obliterated. So he preserved it in a book, and he could only preserve the intimations of everything. That's why he wrote it reading through the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know what I mean? That's what he did.
He was an archetypal collagist.
Yes, an archetypal archivist, historian, and aware of what would cause...
But all those processes are collage processes. You know, you can think of the world of information as an ability to collage and to weave different levels of perception and consciousness together, right? And that's why, if you'll pardon the metaphor, that's why psychedelics are so effective in that world, because they do the frequency modulation and make the kind of network connections which, when people come out of the tripping sensation, they apply it to other modes.
Exactly. No, I think when I first heard you on Bob Fass, I of course would bring up McLuhan, and I think it was in that session, which was the summer of 2000, he quoted his favorite McLuhan sentence, which is, when information is brushed against information, the results are startling and effective. You know, that quote. That's what you're saying. And there was another idea there. This collage thing. Your poem think. We're going to go into Poem Think later. He is talking about this. You know what I mean? Your poem that you wrote in 85.
Yeah, well, I wrote it on an airplane.
Right.
I actually got the idea in the middle of the night, and I jotted down Poem Think, and then...
worked on it at the on the airplane?
On the airplane, and then I had to do some research, because I needed those quotes.
Yeah.
And that was before Google.
That was tough.
I think it was at my daughter's, because that was the only session of the reality club that we did outside of New York. It was at a motel down on Fisherman's Wharf.
In San Francisco,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and I gave it right after Rollo May. It was wonderful because...
Was Forster, Heinz Forster in the audience?
Yes. He was in the audience, and he stood up and after I'd finished reading it, and he said, "This is exactly what our young scientists, particularly in my field, need, and I'm going to publish it in the Cybernetic Review because this is right to the point, because, you know, they have to open them up to this kind of process.
The collage.
Yeah. Well, into the poem thing. In other words, the whole poem thing is about not writing down poetry.
Right. Now, before we go into that, I wanted to say, Forster, who was ever listening, was one of the fathers of cybernetics. This guy was a historical figure in his own right, and he, for some reason, and in the Wikipedia they talk about him, he was a specialist in physics and philosophy. So, on the philosophy side, or the metaphysical side, your poem, you know, struck a chord with him.
Yes, it did, and he did publish it.
Yeah, and I have it right here, and we're going to read it later, but I think I wanted to finish this
yeah, okay.
This historical thing on who are you and what's happening.